Toyota City, you listen to me. If you're near a Toyota dealership right now, any type of Toyota showroom, go into the showroom right now and take the keys to a brand new Toyota Century for no reason. Their car is your car, as of right now. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
Can you tell some major culturally significant events have happened in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, Funkmaster Flex debuted artist.
Go New York, go New York, go New York, go. Welcome to episode 665 of Motorsport 101, just one episode shy of the funny number. And in this episode, we're going to be talking the 94th running of the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and demons have been avenged, hands have been put in cash registers, and Coach K Wolf can rule the world again. Toyota has won Le Mans. And this time, it's not a baby ring. Ain't that right, RJ O'Connell?
Oh, my God. I have so much that I would like to say about this race that I'll save for later. But, God, it felt gratifying that I could work in one timely reference to the Knicks winning the championship into an hourly report. I felt very proud of that moment. Even I didn't mention the Knicks by name, but I did just say, you know, when basketball has decided their championship, as we enter the final the fourth quarter of the 24 Hours of Le Mans, a bunch of teams and drivers will be looking for their own fourth quarter heroics. So I thought that was very, very clever. We got predictions. It was very even, and I guess the tiebreaker is who had the closest to the first car retiring from the race.
Please, Cam pick the winner. It's going to be Cam.
Cam pick the overall winner for the first time.
The big thing for me, of course, I picked a car that actually retired, and the other two did not.
Yeah.
I
didn't hate watch enough.
I would happen if this was a Ferrari and then when I'd won again, I'd have taken full credit for breaking the tie. So it's only fair I give Cameron Buckley his flowers and say, "Well done, sir."
I did buy the scale model. And then
I would love to see it if it was made of more than 3 pixels right now.
It's the number 8 TRO10. This is only on screen. And for a while, this looked like that was going to be the car to win it for Toyota. But there were some interesting twists that happened in this race.
Yes, indeed. I am just happy that I got one of these, but also shoutouts to Kamui Kobayashi, who, after crossing the line, he's the one who took that car home for its victory, getting on the radio and going, "Yeah, I need a beer."
Remember, is the guy who was doing like a 5-minute impromptu stand-up bit during his Rolex 24 in-race interview just to talk about his experience of making a makeshift sauna in the infield of Daytona. Like, there's a lot we got to get through, but Dre, why don't you tell the fine folks where you can find this and other wonderful Motorsport 101 podcasts and written materials?
Indeed, you can find them on youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101, Instagram at motorsport101 pod, TikTok at m101_podcast. We're all personally on Blue Sky and Twitter in some capacity. CBuckley917 for Cam, RJ O'Connell for RJ O'Connell, and Dre Harrison for me. You can also follow us on our website, motorsport101.com. If you want a full written review of all things to come out of Barcelona, where I only make 3 New York Knicks jokes, you should be very proud of me, quite frankly. All of that can be found on the site. And, of course, our Patreon page, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded, as Kira, Raptor, and Jason are doing so right now. Thank you very much. And I'll get out of the way in a hot minute because it's time to review the 94th 24 Hours of Le Mans.
But for victory once more after 3 years away from the top step of the podium, Toyota Racing are heading to win the 2026 Le Mans 24 Hours, the 94th running of the world's greatest endurance motor race, falls to Toyota number 7. Kamui Kobayashi takes the checkered flag at Le Mans. He takes his second win along with his teammate Mike Conway, and now jubilation in the garage. Nyck de Vries, the third member of the team, takes his first win. BMW number 20 Robin Fiennes puts them on the podium and extends their drivers' championship advantage with second place. And the remarkable story of this race for Toyota concludes with a third placed finish for car number 8. They knew they were under pressure. They knew they had potential. But this place, as Toyota knows perhaps above all others, can be mercilessly cruel. But Toyota win in 2026.
If you're familiar with the modern history of the 24 Hours of Le Mans, that you've known that for over three decades, Toyota at Le Mans was a tale of persistent sorrow and frustration, with its lowest moment coming 10 years ago, when, while leading the race with Kazuki Nakajima behind the wheel, seemingly destined to win the 2016 24 Hours of Le Mans, the car retires from the lead as it took the white flag, wouldn't even finish the race. It was the lowest moment in a multi-generational curse for the biggest Japanese automaker, now the biggest automaker in the entire world. And what's interesting is that Toyota did break its curse. It got its first win at Le Mans after 33 years of trying in 2018, and then won four more times to run it to 5 in a row. But many people will point out that it only happened after LMP1 rivals Audi and Porsche left the sport of their own accord due to stuff that was going on behind the scenes that were, let's just say, a little bit bigger than endurance racing. And that left Toyota to get those wins and pick them off against several very ambitious but ultimately hopeless privateer efforts. There was that Alpine program that was really just borrowing the old Rebellion Racing equipment for a bit, and then Alpine built its own thing. But that's neither here nor there. But since the proper start of the OEM hypercar era in 2023, Toyota had gotten reacquainted with that same shitty feeling of disappointment at Le Mans, narrowly finishing second twice to Ferrari in 2023 and 2024, and falling further away last year. But now, at last, Toyota is back on top with a win at Le Mans, with no qualifiers, no yeah buts, no cubic zirconia, no invoking Disney characters, no purported asterisk, going through strong
competition. What are they going to say now?
Going through strong competition to get there in the form of Cadillac Hertz Team Jota and BMW MTWRT, who put forth two very strong efforts all race weekend. The number 20 BMW of Robin Frins, Rene Rast, and Sheldon Vanderlinde surged the lead on the first lap, going from fourth in the grid to first thanks to some stellar driving from Rast. The number 8 Toyota, that's the Sebastian Buemi, Brendan Hartley, and Ryo Hirakawa car, led the most laps after going very early to an alternate pit strategy to try and gain more clean air, because the two Toyotas had not qualified well, because Hyperpole 1 was not good to them. And then Cadillac gained the advantage by being the first to switch the soft tires at night, because all three tire compounds are available. But as the race progressed and in the final moments, it was the number 7 Toyota of Mike Conway, Nyck de Vries, and Kamui Kobayashi that came back from a mediocre first quarter of the race. They were impeded by an untimely puncture and then also a drive shaft sensor problem, which, as Kamui Kobayashi discussed and technical director David Florey later expanded on, put the car into a safe mode that reduced the power for stretches when it got put in there. So they had to be very careful not to kick it back into safe mode. Otherwise, they would have had no chance. But ultimately, it was a safety car for Porsche driver Ihachin Guven's big crash in LMGT3 and a broken down Aston Martin LMGT3 car bringing out a full course yellow, as well as some crafty overtaking, helping the number 7 Toyota take the lead in the final few hours, never giving it up. It's Conway and Kobayashi's second overall wins for Toyota and the first for DeVries, who I did not know until recently was a Rolex brand ambassador. And I'm just thinking next to Stewart, Christensen, and... Look, we've said what we think about Chadwick lately, but at least her accomplishments are socially relevant. Like, what did DeVries done to that point? Well, now he has a Le Mans win. The number 20 BMW came a close second, finishing 10.9 seconds off the win in the second closest competitive finish at the history of the 24 hours of Le Mans, while the number 8 Toyota finished third and the number 12 Jota Cadillac of Will Stevens, Norman Nato, and Louis Delatraz finished third and fourth. Now, of course, Le Mans also multiple races at once and elsewhere in LMP2, inter-Europol competition, a 1-2 finish led to back by, well, 1-2 finish led by back-to-back winners, Kuba Szmakowski, Tom Dillman, and Nick Yeoly. Inter-Europol's two cars were the only ones that could keep in touch with Duquesne team's number 30 car, that's the Dorian Pan, Richard Verschoor, and Julian Andlauer car. When the number 30 suffered a terminal brake failure while leading, it kicked down the door for another inter-Europol win at Le Mans. And if you can believe this, the team's third in 4 years. And also, shout-outs to the LMP2 Pro-Am winners at CrowdStrike Racing by Algarve Pro Racing. Just having a clean race was enough to win your group and get a first-place trophy. So good job to them. And probably
Lauren Heinrich early investment has made me the richest man on earth.
Dude, how does he go into his first 24 hours of Le Mans, a car he's never drove, and just like continue to be awesome? This I don't understand.
Lead the B pillar.
Right.
Again.
We'll get into that shortly. And then in LMGT3, I mean, you want to talk about gutsy performances. TF Sport extending Corvette Racing's legacy of Le Mans success as the number 33 yellow Corvette of Ben Keating, Johnny Edgar, and Nicky Katzberg, picking up the win in commanding fashion. Now, Keating hurt his elbow. This is his first race back since coming back from elbow surgery. Did his mandatory 6 hours of driving as the bronze in the first 8 hours of the race with a quintuple stint to lead it off. That allows Edgar and Katzberg to do all the rest of their driving while the other teams still needed to clear their mandatory bronze driver time. And Edgar runs a quintuple of his own to secure the win. It's the 10th for Corvette and Chevrolet at Le Mans. It comes 25 years after the factory team, which used to be all that was Corvette Racing, won for the first time. Of course, Corvette Racing now. It is the support for customer teams like TF Sport, who've now gone on to win this race. So I'm going to throw it over to Dre Harrison, admittedly the newest endurance racing enthusiast, because this is like test cricket. For you and your view, how big is this win for Toyota to you? Because you can't call it an understory. It's not an underdog story, right? This is the biggest automaker. Like, it's been... It was frustrating that they hadn't won this sooner.
It is, and it makes you think, how did they not for the previous 5 years that led up to this? Because they'd come so close a couple of times as well. I remember watching when they were leading with less than 3 hours to go, and one off-track excursion cost them the win. For me, it means a lot because, and of course, I've got to relate this back to Formula One. I can't help myself here. That 2016 race where David Croft gave the game away while commentating on the Azerbaijan Grand Prix with 10 minutes to go, saying that his old mate Anthony Davidson was going to win Le Mans for Toyota, and said congratulations to him, not knowing that 2 minutes later that car would be dead. And thinking, oh my God, it's the most heartbreaking defeat maybe in Le Mans history.
Sean Haigh's call of that finish is still seared into my brain, and I remember where I was when I heard it, let alone the people that were in the media room at the time howling and gasping and frantically rushing to delete everything that they had just written because they're in a crunch to get this copy to the web as soon as possible. And oh my God, everything you've pre-written, don't pre-write, kids. That's your lesson for today. Don't pre-write because you never know what can happen at the last few minutes of the 24 hours Le Mans.
I said this year in our Discord chat, and we had a couple card-carrying Toyota fans in there, and I said, above any other sporting entity on this earth, Toyota, more than any of them, need to see a body.
Oh, yeah.
It is like, not like... I will never forget the DSC headline from 2016, because I watched that. I was half asleep, and then I suddenly wasn't, because I was leaping up and down in my living room.
Because that was
Porsche's 18th win. And my girlfriend at the time was going fucking berserk.
That was Porsche's 18th win at the 24 hours of Le Mans, and it happened because
I will never forget. The Toyota wins the 23 hours and 59 minutes of Le Mans as the headline on DSC.
Oh, man. That's the line right there. And, like, it's a curse that goes back to the first time that Toyota attempted this. For those who don't know, in the late 60s, Toyota and Yamaha collaborated on the Toyota 2000 GT. They also collaborated on a batch of prototypes that we now collectively know as the Toyota 7. And one of the things that that project was meant to do was bring Toyota into Le Mans about a decade and a half before they first showed up in 1985. Then, tragically, over a period of 18 months, two Toyota factory drivers are killed during testing accidents, which eventually leads the Toyota 7 project to be shuttered. And in the case of Sachio Fukuzawa, leads to a 12-year legal battle between Toyota and his family that eventually gets settled out of court a dozen or so years later, with still a lot of bad feelings left attached to it.
There's still elements of that that have not been exposed to the public 50 years on.
Right. So when I say that this is, like, to use an American sports terminology, that this is Curse of the Billy Goat type shit, except it's much darker and bleaker because it's professional motorsport. And Toyota did get that win to break the curse of the Toyota 7, right? But it never felt fulfilling because we don't know what could have been if Audi and Porsche were still here. Hell, if Nissan was still here, because they were here for a hot second and then quickly disappeared in one of the most humiliating high-profile busts in LMP1 modern endurance racing history. We don't know what that would have been like. And then 2023 happens and Toyota, their only blemish on what would have otherwise been a perfect season, is a second place finish where if that car does not lock the rears and Ryo Hirakawa does not throw it in the gravel into Arnage, I think they win that race. I don't know if they run out the rest of a perfect season afterwards if they win that race, but regardless, that second place was the only blemish on a season where Toyota won every other race, and Toyota came close again in 2024. And I don't think Toyota was as bad in 2025, but they fell off operationally. Their concept had seen the end of its life, and so Toyota, to their credit, decided, you know what? Let's transform this thing. One, into a car that actually looks good, and two, one that gives them a wider operating window to work with just in case they don't have all the horsepower and the weight that they want, right?
Kind of. I still think that 2023 swing at the BOP 9 days before the race is horseshit. 29 years on, World War II, etc. What I will say, Toyota, for the longest time, were the masters of getting to 22 hours to go and then throwing this race straight in the trash barrel. In 1994, against Porsche with a Group C car and a badly fitting GT1 outfit, Jeff Krosnoff, who of course is no longer with us, loses a gear linkage. Second place.
Right. He has to crawl under the car to get to it. You get underneath of it. Like 1998 and 1999, the Toyota GT1.
I'll get to those. Yeah. I want to get to those later. And then up against the might of Audi and Porsche, they went bar for bar with them across seasons. They made Audi and Porsche dig into depths of performance that they had previously not had to. But Le Mans always eluded them, whether it was a crash, whether it was faulty FIA metering equipment in 2014 that struck the seven out of one of the most crushingly dominant Le Mans that we had seen up to that point. That car was invincible.
Yeah.
And then it was gone overnight. 2015, not at the races. Embarrassment. They go in, they retool everything. You talked about 2016.
Yeah.
And if you watch 2016 live, I mean, I think it was the Eurosport commentary talked about it. You wouldn't put that plot in a movie. No one would believe it.
Right.
And yet it happened. And then in 2017, in their last dance with Porsche up to that point, they have the dominant car and they go from having a stranglehold on the race to all three cars out in about a 50-minute span.
And that's the one that everybody forgets, right? Because that only happened when it was still night out. They didn't give away the race in literally the final 5 minutes.
But I'll focus on a pair at the end of the 90s. In 1998, they debut a car called the TSO20.
You know it as
that is the most regulation abusive race car perhaps ever spawned.
And it's beautiful. I've seen it in person twice, including this past week.
And the legend of that car, of course, is being dominantly fast in all three of its outings and not winning any of them.
Right.
But I do think in wearing the livery that the car did last Sunday from 1998 and in defeating that which defeated them in 1999 at BMW, at last the TSO20's ghost can rest.
And not just that, Toyota finally has closure for the lowest moment in the most infamous curse in endurance racing history. I think it's safe to say it's not going to, you know, expunge the misdeeds of Toyota higher ups 50, 60 some odd years ago, almost, because, you know, that's an entirely different thing from trading away Babe Ruth for a piano. Right. But, but it is, you know, we don't all get closure in our lives when something terrible happens to us. Like, we don't get closure when we get dumped by somebody, right? And it's like bad. We don't ever get that closure of just like a lot of things in life that are bad and leave you wondering what if for years and years, possibly to the end of our lifetimes. Toyota, in this instance, got that closure, and they could say, we won Le Mans. We survived the first biggest hurdle. Because, right, one thing that gets lost in the discussion of, oh, Toyota didn't beat anybody winning Le Mans those last five times. Finishing Le Mans by itself is a hard thing. If it wasn't a hard thing, they probably wouldn't have had to wait 33 years to win it in the first place.
That was the thing about it, was snatching defeat from the jaws of victory over and over. Less than an hour and a half to go in 94, less than 90 minutes to go in 1998. Running the lead BMW down in a burst of speed and then is run off the road by a private BMW. Uh-huh. And the same lap, Ukio Katayama has maybe the greatest save in motorsport history as he blows a tire at VMAX on the run down to Indianapolis.
Right. That's...
And over and over again. But they ain't going to say anything about this one.
And
they had to scratch and claw and connive their way to victory against two very, very strong opposing cars.
Oh, yeah. Those two in particular. I mean, we can get into the minutiae of, you know, how close they came and all that. But I mean, a couple things here about some of the drivers. I mean, people will look, they'll look at the race, they'll look at the B-pillar results, and they'll suggest that Mike Conway was not at his best. And you know what? He probably wasn't. And I'm sure he would likely be one of the first to admit that maybe that wasn't one of his finest days behind the wheel. But number one, he's now a two-time Le Mans winner. Number two, he's now won a WEC race in each of the last 10 seasons, all with Toyota. Number three, there's rumors about his future. He may go to another manufacturer. He, in his late 40s, might just decide, you know what? I've won Le Mans twice. I've won a couple world championships. I've done everything I need to do. I can, if this is my last ride, I can just walk away from here. Then again, I could say the same thing about Kamui Kobayashi. Kamui Kobayashi could just walk away from here.
Kamui Kobayashi, man.
But
Kamui Kobayashi, I have to say, not the luckiest man ever in racing, still is waiting for that first Super Formula win. I don't think he'll have to care. Leader of the B-pillar, 3/10 clear of the field, and absolutely imperious when it came down to winning time.
Oh my
God. And you know what? He was so good that it made... He made everyone else down the stretch of that race look kind of ordinary. And I like that at 39, this guy who has raw talent beyond anything you've seen and just did not get the luck because, well, his F1 team shuttered in the offseason in 2009. He was going to be in the TF110. And then he wasn't. He's so goddamn good.
And I need to also give flowers to Nick DeVries. I mean,
yes, we do.
He was binned off by AlphaTauri in 2023. It was not a pretty exit. It was an exit that had people wondering if he should have even gotten the opportunity. An opportunity, that, by the way, that only a few years ago, Nick DeVries was looking like he was going to be next man up at Toyota. That seat eventually goes to Ryo Hirakawa instead. DeVries finds his way back into Toyota in the inevitable seat of being Kobayashi and Conway's co-driver in the spot that Jose Maria Lopez once filled, which was, you know, always the seat that was under the highest scrutiny. Conway probably wasn't at his best, but you know what? Nick DeVries was the dad that stepped up. He was the dad.
That is the most, RJ, that is the most impressed I've ever been with Nick DeVries in a race car, bar none.
Oh, my God, yeah.
That was his best race. And you know what else? Pencil that boy in for a golden melon. Because if he does not do a crossover dive bomb on the number 12 Cadillac to take the lead, that car probably doesn't have the margin to play it safe down the stretch with the BMW bearing down on them. We'll get to BMW in a moment.
Yeah.
Spectacular overtake, one of a couple. Out of the Toyota crew, Hartley had one around the outside of Indianapolis in the night that was porn.
I mean,
racing
Dre,
porn.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Dre, the number 8 Toyota led the most laps in this race, comes away with a third place finish. It's a total team effort. Like, it's a great result. You won the race, you get two cars on the podium. Oh, man, I just think, for the selfishness of my pick, and because I bought the car, I would have thought, man, it would have been cool for Sebastian Buemi, 10 years on from the lowest moment of his endurance racing career, to get that W back and become a 5-time Le Mans winner. Hartley would get his 4th. Hirakawa would get his 2nd. But I mean, ultimately, Toyota won. So it's just like, it sucks for them on an individual level, but as a total team effort, you take it all the way.
You take it all the way. I mean, the talk was before this preview started, this feels like the end of an era for Toyota anyway. We know Conway is almost certainly going to be leaving at the end of the season. There's rumblings that Brendan Hartley might be looking for a change of scenery as well. We don't know how many of these guys are going to be back here next year.
Nick DeVries could be gone next year. You never know.
Could clear the decks.
Yeah, it could be a deck clearer. I mean, because even I know, and I'm the least knowledgeable of the three by a mile when it comes to sports cars, that has been a Toyota core for as long as I can remember. At least five of those 6 drivers has been the core of the Toyota fleet.
Webby's been here since the start of this endeavor in 2012. He's been here for 15 seasons. He's not going to be leaving, by the way.
that seven car has been manned by the Conway Kobayashi tandem, you know, partnered as well with Lopez and then DeVries. And then DeVries later on since that 2017 race, where that was the dominant car until it very suddenly wasn't, with catastrophic clutch failure out of the lead. That has been the staple, that has been the front running Toyota for much of that time. Just usually not at Le Mans.
Yeah.
Definitely. What a call. And if it is the end, what better way to bow out than one more victory in a race they've been chasing for the last half decade? So many demons to avenge, so many stories to tell, so many near misses as well amongst this era, which is just doubly heartbreaking when this is the toughest race to win maybe in the world. And yeah, a magnificent win. And yeah, good. As an F1 guy, I'm delighted for Kamui, who has always been, I think, underappreciated as an F1 driver and beyond, since he's now become one of the real darlings of endurance racing. And Nyck de Vries had a very hard time in Formula One, and some of that was deserved. I'm not going to deny that or revise history on that. But it goes to show you that you don't necessarily just fluke a Formula E World Championship. He was able to go over, and he's now got a Le Mans win to his name. Good for him, because, you know, he's drove really well in this race. He's got a Golden Melon nominee in there as well, which is always fun. Yeah. You know, like, that was the most impressive. Again, I echo Cam's sentiment. It was the most impressive run I've seen from Nyck de Vries on a race car in his career. He can do this at the very highest level, and that's a hell of a way to silence the doubters. A Le Mans victory.
Love his end of the race when it was like, I think it was the second to last lap, and he's just like, just calm it down, everyone in the garage.
Which is funny, because like the whole, like, Conway was saying after the race that like Nyck was the most nervous man up in that pit wall.
I don't blame him.
Not at all.
Yeah, because he was the only one of them that hadn't won it.
And to kind of expand on that, and in reference to Toyota's past wins and a lot of the litigation and relitigation of those. But with competition, it just means more.
Yeah, of
course. And they were, for years, well, win a real ring. BMW pressed them to the ends of the earth this race. Their old enemy from 1999, that they themselves lost the car out of the lead that year. And in 1999, before that puncture for the 3, the 15 car was going to have an extra stop. It was going to be that close. And BMW came out in favor then. They tried their damnedest this time.
I mean, BMW
is real.
Yeah, BMW and Cadillac, I think, as a collective, we could talk both about them, because that's the thing that I came away with for this race, is that you have three manufacturers who are just fighting hammer and tong in a race where, in many years, you've been lucky to have two competitive manufacturers go hammer and tong like this. And it's a shame that one of them had to lose, let alone two. BMW put forth their most complete effort with the M hybrid V8 at Le Mans ever, and it's not even close.
I would say for this car, period, the only competition was maybe Daytona last year, and even then that fell apart late. Now, BMW, and especially Sheldon Vanderlinde, I have to talk about for a second. He put in a marathon stint before the final driver swap on Sunday morning, and there was nothing left in him or that car. He got everything out of it before he handed it to Frines. Just not quite enough in the nighttime. They were that last tiny little percentile off, and they did get a gap. They did have something to work with in the daytime hours, but the safety car that we got for Guven's crash, which we'll talk about later on, just put them on the back foot relative to Toyota, and then Toyota had spectacular daytime pace.
Yeah.
That is to take nothing away from the 20 crew. They balled out.
Yeah.
See what happens when you put a real livery on that car?
You know what? You know what it did also? That reminded me, like, man, I hadn't thought about Rene Rast being that dude for a minute. And then
I didn't ever forget
when he drove from fourth to the lead on the opening lap. And then everybody just kept, I mean, that guy's sensational. Robin Frenz drove like he drove like the guy that about this time 15 years ago, everybody was wondering, why isn't this guy getting the call up to Formula One? Because he's clearly better than all the other guys that are. Yeah, ultimately, it didn't work out.
Rene unleashed the berserker on that start. That was nuts. But yeah, Frenz, unfortunately, just too much to do. And we talk about that team effort with Toyota and having two bullets in the chamber, which the other two entities did not. We'll talk about that in a minute. The 8 car was able to run an alternate tire strategy and run blocker.
Yep.
And basically hold the 20 back. And that afforded Toyota the opportunity to just take it easy with the 7. Kamui was so ginger through traffic, he almost crashed through traffic by accident. Because in not going for the move, the LMP2 he was passing was kind of disorganized. And Frenz got it down to about 10.9 at the end.
Yep.
Second closest finish, because 1966 doesn't really count. They orchestrated that badly.
Yeah.
And you're going to be hard-pressed to find something. Someone should make a movie about it. Where Ken Miles actually goes to Le Mans 65 and then his transmission explodes.
Oh, man. I mean,
creative liberties and all that. But
right.
That last little stretch, I mean, supporter of the show, Sasha and I were watching it, and it's like, Frenz is overdriving, just trying to get everything he can out of the Beamer. And it was just too much. And then Kamui, I think two laps from the end, puts in a lap of don't even try it.
Yeah.
They had it in hand, but
the silencer.
Cadillac, though. I mean, Cadillac, the number 12 car, that was a car that I think, again, another story of that car so quick during the night, especially with the move that they were going to be the ones to take soft tires at night when the track temperature dips. Toyota and BMW still pretty much committed to running mediums as long as they can. Cadillac switches over to softs, and they're able to get the most out of it, and they're able to work the red front. For a while, it looked like Cadillac was going to win this race. One of the two Jota cars was definitely going to win this race. I tell you what, man. If there is anybody that is at the head of my commiserations list, it's got to be Sebastian Bourdais in the number 38 car with Jack Aitken and Earl Bamber. If not for a $2 part and a power steering system failure, Sebastian Bourdais might have finally won the race overall. Because remember, he won his class. We're not going to get in the baggage that came with it. He finished runner-up overall 3 times with Peugeot. Overall wins feel a lot different than winning just your class. I know that's... He never thought he'd get another chance at it. And that was probably his best and last chance to do it at age 47.
He's Dale Earnhardt at the Daytona 500, man. It's every way you can lose this race, any way you can finish second, Sebastian Bourdais has. And that 38 car was phenomenal for much of the race. That it was 38 versus 20 at the head of the field for a good while in this race, just going back and forth.
Several hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is, it was like a splash of cold water to the face, because the 38 was leading. Then it's P2. Then it's in the garage, and they're taking the nose off of it. Seb Bourdais climbs out and whips his seat across the room because it's a terminal issue.
Yeah,
it's shades of 2010 when he put the 3 Peugeot on pole. Back when they could just do 319s as a race pace, as a normal thing. No, they could not sustain 319s as a race pace. His car never even got the chance to throw a connecting rod through the side of the block because the suspension element ripped out of the tub and KO'd the car 3 hours into the race.
But
in the lead.
Yeah. I also like that the 12 car picked him up. Like, Louis Delatraz maybe didn't leave a very good first impression at Jota in Spa, perhaps. Definitely did this time. Will Stevens, man,
the lad.
Would you have ever thought, Trey, that Will the Lad Stevens would be the straw that stirs the drink for a major manufacturer hypercar effort a decade down the road from the time he's the first voice in the original Motorsport 101 intro? God, he is so good.
Will the Lad Stevens, all 5'5" of him. Yeah, I mean, that might be a generous measure. It wouldn't be like us men to round up our heights.
Congratulations as well to Jimmy Broadbent for getting married and then telling the wedding photographer, and this is on his stream, could you make me look 6 foot? And then the photographer's just like, no.
Impossible.
I'm such a sweetheart. I love
the NLS driver.
The MLS driver. Don't mind me. No, I was going to say, I would never have thought when Will Stevens was in F1. And again, it goes to show you that F1 should never be the be-all and end-all of how to describe a driver's career, because the man has become a staple elite sports car driver, and he put Caddy on his back. Like, the entire 12 crew was phenomenal in that race. Like, Norman Nahto was the fastest gold driver on the entire field. He was exceptional. Stevens put the team on his back when he needed him to. He was great. Della Traz, who's again had a mixed impression over his time in sports cars racing, was right up there with the very best out there again. Great job from him. I want to mention as well Seb Bourdais. You mentioned a minute ago. Seb Bourdais is one of the best drivers of this generation. I stand by that. I've always stood by that. You know, Champ Car deserves its flowers and his role in that success. He's 47 years of age now. Like, he knows time is just about up. And I heard his, and forgive me, RJ, I saw the quotes on racer.com when it came around at the time, and just reading that on just the gut wrench when you read it and you just go, this race is just not for me to win. And you know, the man lives down the road. Like, he would never have to buy a beer in town again if he ever actually it just wasn't to be. It's a real shame because the 38 and the 12 were sensational. They could have easily had two cars on the podium.
Yeah.
Easily. Another year.
And having another bullet in the chamber might have helped turn the tide against Toyota when they were able to deploy the 8 basically to help the 7 car, and to say nothing of the second BMW, all of the pain and misery and suffering that usually befalls a BMW hypercar was focused squarely on the 15 car.
Right. And it all started with the collision with an LMP2 car that it just snowballs from there. They lose power late in the race while they're already out of contention. The
steering column came loose in the middle of the fucking race.
Wow. I mean, that's not even the silliest thing to happen with the car, because I got two minutes to talk about the mess that was the end of Hyperpole, where Jack Aitken wins Hyperpole and then has to give back the Hyperpole medal because he had cut through the work from the working lane to the fast lane before he was instructed. They've given him the medal, and now he has to give it back so they can give it back to Dries Vanthoor, who ends up winning Hyperpole.
That picture on the socials was devastating.
They had to give him the medal back with Aitken looking like Oliver Twist asking for a second bowl of gruel and then having to complete the whole ceremony in the back of BMW's garage.
Had to do was wait 5 freaking minutes for a steward's decision to come in before you get to the podium ceremony, man. And you could have saved a lot of people a lot of public embarrassment, including yourselves.
Yeah.
Nope. Better go to motorsport, huh?
Let me think. The exclusive grandeur and all that stuff. Like, I love this race, but sometimes it can be a bit silly. I've carved in a segment where we could talk for I don't know, maybe 10 minutes to talk about pleasant surprises, unpleasant surprises, and commiseration throughout the race. Oh, my God, dude. Other people that I feel bad for. Dorianne Pan was nearly the first woman to win a major class at Le Mans 48 years.
And I was so close to doubling up.
When
I mean,
it wasn't just that. It was that Duquesne had the car of the race. And Richard Verschoor is putting in work in his first impression at Le Mans. Like,
he was great.
Julian Antlauer didn't have to carry the team, right?
No.
Julian was great. All three of them, excellent all week. Dorian Pan was her all week.
Right.
Dorian Pan was one of the top silvers in the class. Look, I know, I'll be real with you, people get a bit weird about Dorian Pan on the internet, but let's not make any mistake. She's a phenomenally talented sports car driver. That's what she always should have been. This is her calling, and this was her race. Yeah. What a damn shame. Because that
mechanical failure on the fucking Orica 07, which has been the de facto spec car for 9 years.
And for good reason, because it's reliable. The brake exploded, and like this
brake I don't want to break this to explode on planet Earth. Going down the Mulsanne is right at the top of that list.
I don't think the 30 was ever out of the top two across the entire race until his brake exploded in class. And it's a real shame because, as mentioned, all three drivers in that car were superb. Pan was one of the best silvers in the field. Richard Verschoor, for a first time at Le Mans, was excellent. And we all know about Julian Andlauer's quality. We know he's an exceptional sports car driver. That was a phenomenal team effort, and they were looking good for a historic class win. And that was that. Just like that, it was over. And there are so many Dorian Pan fans out there, and rightly so. She's an incredible driver, and you could feel the heartbreak across social media. It was devastating. Dame time didn't escape. Like, Dame time happened again, and it's not even Dame time on the car this time, and yet somehow the curse lingers.
Yeah, you had Dorian Pan in the race, who had Sarah Bovee as the Grand Marshal. You have Michelle Gatton putting really great addition to the World Feed commentary team.
Michelle Gatting was the best commentator at Le Mans this year. She was exceptional.
She adds so much to the team.
So good.
If Michelle Gatting is going to be shut out of racing opportunities for no fault of her own because of the mismanagement of Iron Dames, like, she'd make a hell of a television pundit. But first and foremost, I want to see her get back into a goddamn competitive race car again. Because we all do.
Absolutely.
The race's loss was the commentary box's gain. Michelle Gatton was informative, witty, funny, was able to correct the men at times on pointing out things like rules and regulations and the technical nuances of the track. I love the little joke she made about Dorian being so small that when you have to put the driver's seat in the car, she has to put a sofa in for Dorian because of how small she is. Bless. Like, I mean, they got her listed as 5'2". I think that's generous, quite frankly. But Gatting was wonderful. Like, an immensely brilliant addition to the box. For a first time as a major commentator, absolutely astonishingly good. She had no business being as good as she was in that box. You know what? Incredible.
That Lawrence Vanthoor guy who didn't even plan to be here was all right too.
Fucking
he was. It wasn't going to be Martin Haven, now was it? Martin haven't a clue.
I did love, by the way, David Addison, Graham Goodwin's banter about, do you know why two boxers don't have sex with each other before they fight? It's because they hate each other. Add that to the list of unhinged shit that said at Le Mans overnight. But yes, somebody wanted
still
to
might
add,
not be as bad as the heroin comment from a couple years ago.
Still might not be as bad as Martin accidentally killing John Brooks and Graham reaching for the mic and said, "No, John Brooks is alive. I just spoke with him last week." John Brooks, the legendary sports car racing photographer.
I've got to say as well, like, it's worth commenting. Got commentators. One, I'm biased because I worked with him at Autosport, but David Addison is great. I love the line that he said that he's like the real adult in the room out of the big mainline commentators. I've joked this before, but I said, quote, "I could get us cancelled by 2 a.m., which I love David Addison for that. He's great. And the other mention as well, on Radio Le Mans, at one point, we had Jimmy Johnson in the commentary box, and he was drunk as a skunk.
Dude, I have never heard that man sound that way. I have never heard. I could not believe how drunk he was.
Dude, that's not Jimmy,
Jimmy
Johnson.
Was wasted.
Dude, that's wasted. Not Jimmy Johnson. That's not Jimmy Johnson. That's Dale Jr.'s buddy, Jimmy Jam. Because people have only learned over time that Jimmy Johnson is actually a lot closer to Dale Earnhardt in terms of his origin story and his upbringing than he is to Jeff Gordon. He just so happened to be Jeff Gordon's protege for a bit.
I think he turned out all right. Yeah. I want to pour one out for Genesis Magma Racing, who showed up to first Le Mans.
Great effort.
Yeah.
Great effort, was going very well until it very suddenly wasn't with the 19 car. They were running, I think, fourth out of sequence, but fourth.
Yeah.
In that sort of middle group, we will have to talk about the BOP for a moment. Until they have powertrain. Yeah, we have to talk about the BOP. But great first effort. Sadly, lost the 17 car with a quite spectacular right front suspension failure. They cut too much of the curb on the inside of the opening chicane, and it basically blew the right front corner smooth off the car.
I appreciate that Edgar Wright reposted Genesis doing a parody of Baby Driver centered around young Mathis Joubert, because look, it's not Edgar Wright's fault that Kevin Spacey turned out to be an actual real life villain, because that was such a fun movie, man.
It was a very fun
real movie. And the 19, importantly, the 19 did make the flag. Yeah. A few powertrain issues, but did make the flag. Solid first effort.
Yeah.
And pretty much shadowed their chassis twin Alpine for much of the race when they were running in terms of lap times.
Yeah.
But
Paul Lim-Chatan was top 20 on the B pillar as well. So there was some pace there for a gold, exceptional.
And not just that, but
very good pace out of the car.
One of the late additions to the program, because remember, Andre and Pipo have way more experience in that project than anything else. Alpine gets two top 10s out of their last effort at Le Mans, which, I mean, you'd love to.
Alpine were very weird. I wonder if they did have reliability concerns with their engines, because they looked like they were in the fight throughout the week, and then their straight line speed was just down for the whole race. They did make the flag with both cars. They pretty much ran trouble free. Uh-huh. But we did have a BOP this year that I would say was very good at the front, because there was nothing to separate between the Toyota, the Caddy, and the BMW. And then there was a gap to the Genesis when it was running, the Ferraris, the Ferrari had a race and a half. We'll expand on them. And the Alpines and one of the Aston Martins. And then you have to go about 3 miles down the road to get to Peugeot.
Dude, that was really, really bad. Like, it isn't like the thing, like, for people that love to deal in like conspiracy theories and corruption, isn't the thing that like the ACO are always here to look out for the national interest, right? Because it sure as shit didn't show when Peugeot is running P last, the only other car that joined it out in the first hurdle of qualifying out in Q1 was the 83 Ferrari. I don't know how those cars managed to almost sneak away a top 10 finish. One of them got a world championship point out of it all. Because remember, dude, the 101 car is invisible.
Yes, and the 101 car. Wayne Taylor Racing didn't stink up the joint.
Yeah,
no, they were solid.
Look,
they were solid. They didn't see engine oil pressure 0.0 on their steering wheel,
which might be
the single worst thing to ever see on the steering wheel of a racing car.
Right. Like, they had some weird procedural penalties, but I will say this, that is an effort that is more like the team that was an IMSA juggernaut for years and years and less like a field filler. And I sincerely hope it leads to better things down the road the rest of the IMSA season.
Please.
I just say one more note on Alpine. 12th on the B pillar average, Victor Martins. Superb.
Fantastic this year.
How is this
Victor
only
Martins is a talent. How on earth did he How was he so mid in Formula 2? He was robbed by the ARTs around him. That kid is a talent. Holy shit.
Well, it's not like Martin was ever slow in F2. He was usually just having cars land on him.
Yeah, he's normally having Alex Dunn put him in a wall somewhere at some point or another, poor guy. But Victor Martins was incredible. What a talent.
Dude, he was. Yeah, he's great. Man, you know what? Peugeot, bad.
I'm sure they
got clipped. Like
I just gotta say this.
I feel horrible for him.
If I'm them, I cancel the program and I out the table on the way out like it's the Epstein files.
Yeah, it's funny to mention that because on Thursday they've announced that they're bringing upgrades to the car.
Really?
As an aside, This is embargoed material by the time we're recording, but by the time this episode comes out, it will not be embargoed material that they are announcing upgrades to the program.
The biggest thing for me with this, because this is the third year of this now since they put a wing on that car.
Yeah. It's just never been good at Le Mans since they stuck a wing on it.
But here's the thing. We know what the numbers were last year.
Uh-huh.
And they were bad. And everyone, I think, kind of collectively went, well, why have they done that? And then it turned out that it was horrible and they were completely off the pace. We come here a year later, a race removed from them being on pole at probably the most Le Mans adjacent track otherwise at Spa. And they were 5 to 6 seconds a lap off the pace. Now, I am not under the impression, I think we have a big enough sample size.
Yeah.
I think we can say that the Peugeot 9X8 is not a good race car. I don't think it's the operating window, though. Why have they nerfed a car that needs the help?
It's not
5 seconds a lap off the pace.
No. And even if it was, why aren't you helping it out as the BOP at the ACO to get them more into play? What are you hurting them for at this point?
That one, I don't understand.
I just don't get it.
But
I don't get it. I do think, even if Ferrari were closer in the fight this year, man, the 50 and 51 made asses of themselves pretty much all 24 hours.
The 50 car dies. Which one of them had the Mick Schumacher happen to them?
50. The 50 car. The 50 car was the one where most of the bad things happened. Where it, have you seen that one Cartoon Network skit, White Explosion from Inside the House?
Yeah.
You could have it mean some things. In this case, this car's fire extinguisher went boom. And their race was pretty much over from there. And then it was more over as catastrophic electrical failure put the car out.
Yeah.
The 51 was just...
committing war crimes.
Messy.
Yeah.
Very messy.
The only one that ran a clean race was the 83. And for a moment, it didn't.
It didn't, actually. The 83 was the, unfortunately, suffered a fuel miscalculation. They had to splash and dash the end of this race.
Oh, yeah.
They lost out positions on it.
They lost the chance to beat the factory cars again, man. Damn. I gotta say, unless you're a Ferrari fan, I don't think you're that upset that Ferrari didn't make it a four-peat.
Understandable. I'm a Ferrari man, and I'm like, yeah, I get it. You know, it's...
Well, given the first thing Ferrari did was go and have a extreme bitch about the BOP in the media after.
Yep.
I think my empathy well's all tapped out, waving the flag of the number 6 Porsche.
Yeah, I think the big three between Toyota, Porsche, Ferrari love to take turns having herd asses. That's my feeling. Hey, there's no shame in it. There's no shame in having a hurt ass. You just got to be honest about it. Job well done to everybody. Also, Ben Keating. Like, we get Ron Driver so much shit, right? And understandably so, right? Because they're typically wealthy. They get to live a lifestyle that we can only dream of. And then they go and embarrass us and they ruin the races for a lot of our favorite drivers, right? Ben Keating. Ben Keating coming off a broken elbow not even the fastest guy, but just willing to go out there and drive 3.5 intense hours simultaneously, back to back to back to back in the car with the injury.
And RJ, what I love is how he put it afterwards. Like, he wanted to cut his arm off. He was in horrendous pain in the car. And he also said, winning is a hell of a painkiller.
Yeah, 100% for sure. And I'll say this as well. Johnny Edgar was the designated silver in that number 33 car. Johnny Edgar is not going to stay silver for long, because next year, Johnny Edgar better have a freaking factory contract, man.
He ain't looked like a silver in that car.
Corvette Racing, sign him to a full factory deal. Make a part of the Corvette Racing factory, because if you don't, somebody else is.
On a side note, I love it. One more people that I want to point out here. Peter Dempsey, best bronze by miles.
You know why that is, though? It's because we got it all backwards. It's because they've accidentally mixed up him and Sally Yolich's medals here. You just got to flip them, and it makes sense.
I get it now.
I feel horrible for the 91 Porsche crew who fought their way to the lead, got dropped back down with a couple technical issues, were on their way back into the fight. Again, I'm going to repurpose a statement from a few minutes ago. Places to lose the steering on your race car. The Mulsanne straight / chicanes are right at the top of places I don't want that to happen.
Nope.
And Guven hit that wall a ton.
Stacked it. That's a show car now, the 91 car.
I don't even know if it's a show car. You're going to see those panel gaps.
Double shame for Guven. He was the fastest guy in NMG GT3 on average pace. It was incredible.
Oh, so good.
Guven was insane. Nothing
to show for it.
What a shame.
He was insanely good in the GT class. I'll tell you what, Toyota just about almost got a Sunday sweep, given Denny Hamlin boots to asses over at Pocono, and the Ancient One in its last dance, the RCF GT3, coming home P2 in GT3.
If there's one thing I can't understand, is that why Lexus ran so little bronze time so early in the race, because that was the time to use it, but like, and you have two good bronze drivers in Tom Van Rompuy and Petr Umbarescu, who you could have used more, because we didn't just see it this year with Keating. We saw it last year with Ryan Hardwick doing yeoman's work shifts behind the wheel early on in the race, getting out of the car so Richard Leitz and Ricardo Pera do all the work. Like, that's the meta, at least it seems like to me.
They just didn't do it. And it meant that they were down the stretch, they had to run drivers who did a good job, but just got ripped to pieces by that 33 vet.
Mm-hmm. Because when your drive time obligations are done, you're unshackled in as far as that goes.
It's part of the game.
Any other commiserations, surprises to add to the list?
I think we cover the majority of them.
Right. So let's get to the biggest abstract story that broke out of Friday, press conference day, the most stressful day for me on my side of the glass. And that we got a lot of stuff. We got a new pit lane building that's coming to Le Mans by the end of the decade, or at least the start of the next. Finally.
Remember, the one we have now is from 1990, first time they redid the pit lane here.
Oh boy, and it sure shows that it's from 1990 every time you step into the media center, and it looks like they hadn't changed the furniture since they bought it in 1990, but I digress.
Neat part, you can actually watch the, I believe this was ESPN Wide World of Sports still, with Bob Varsha actually going and doing the tour of the building. It is on YouTube.
Holy shit, man. I got to go
catch that in the Discord server when we're done.
I'll catch that up later. But the big announcement was the ACO, the FIA, and IMSA revealing the first framework of the 2030 hypercar regulations. And what we've expected is going to come true, that in 2030, we are going to have a second step of convergence, not two technical regulations racing together, but a single unified technical platform. Here are the bullet points here. They're all going to be two-wheel drive cars. They're still going to have hybrids, and you can choose to develop your own hybrid or your own tub, or you could buy one from an existing partner, you know, Elm DH style. The power and the weight are going to go up 20 extra kilowatts, target weight of about 1040 kilograms. They're never going to be as light as LMP1's hybrid anymore. We just kind of go.
The 963 certainly won't.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Everybody's got to bring a new car. There is maybe a hope that you can adapt old cars into the new regulations, but that's more of a hope than anything.
Doonan talked about it a little bit, that there's a possibility you could basically Evo an existing LMDH into it.
Yeah, which would be fair, right? But we have to wait and see more because so little of this is known. And the big one is 5-year homologation period, no performance-driven evolution Joker upgrades like you have now. So unless you are in such a dire state, you cannot just, you know, Evo your way to making a good car even better like you can now.
They've pulled the token system effectively from the regulations.
Oh, and hydrogen cars are part of it, too, I guess. But that's all big wait and see. The Toyota liquid hydrogen car just did its first demo lap. And Kaz Nakajima, who drove it, says this thing's not ready to run 24 hours. So that's big wait and see. But
yeah, I'm pretty sure that car actually had a mechanical issue on that lap. We did see footage of it. It does sound neat because, like, if you've heard the GR Corolla that they run with the liquid hydrogen, that thing sounds fucking crazy.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Because hydrogen is the big way to, you know, be more responsible while also maintaining the sound. Apart from...
Look, we're never going to run out of hydrogen. That I'm quite sure of.
Yeah.
That's the most abundant thing there is.
I mean, Dre, when I looked at this, when I got like all the stuff Friday from this, my impression was this sounds so reasonable. What do you make of all this from the outside?
I think this was a Porsche wish list to get them back in the series, to be honest with you.
Funny who just remarked about saying that these 2030 regulations are very interesting. I'm very curious to see if Thomas Laudenbach still has that job by then.
What I would say, I feel like there was only one party, though, who doesn't like these rules.
What would that be?
That'd be Ferrari, who had an enormous bitch about the effective killing of LMH before the race.
Is that good?
We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens, because the big crux for them is they want to build the tub. They want to build the hybrid system.
But they can't.
What this basically feels... Well, that's the thing. What this kind of feels like is that it's just LMDH, but you have the option to do it yourself. And I think that's all it needed to be. I think that is very reasonable. I think the option to grandfather, I think the option to grandfather existing cars, if they do go that direction, I think that's a good move.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, we heard more bad news out of the German auto industry. BMW is in a bad way right now. Today. I think this all makes a lot of sense for pretty much everyone involved. I think it makes it a lot easier to BOP cars that are two-wheel drive as a blanket rather than some two, some four at a higher speed range, some four on different tire widths.
And that's the thing, right? Because this is going to solve the one big problem is a lot of the balance of performance discourse will be, it's not going to go away, but it will at least be alleviated because you're not having to juggle two different technical platforms at the same time, which it turns out it's a hard thing to do.
Hey, it's almost like I called that out on my very first episode on this show. It's like I called that shit 4 years prior to it happening.
It's been awesome. Has it been perfect? No. But it's been awesome, and I really hope that when I enter my 40s, when this kicks in, that there will be more good shit to come. Manufacturers will stay. Manufacturers that had left will want to come back. New parties will want to get involved.
I like everything about it. I think it's all very reasonably thought out. I think it's smart to make it a simpler kind of cross-pollination process between WEC and IMSA of just run the same rules in the same wind tunnel, because that wind tunnel, as we've heard, has caused a bit of a divide in the BOP, which was corrected for this year. It's kind of wild it took as long as it did to correct. I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
I think it's very sensible.
You know what? I completely agree. I was wondering, like, where's the catch so far? So far, the only catch is we don't have the full list of technical regulations, but we might have them before the end of the year. I think that's the plan.
If these are the core tenets of it, I think that they can draw up the rest around it pretty well. But of course, that we've seen the ACO and the FIA find a way to fuck up a good thing before. We're just going to have to wait and see.
Yeah, we still got at least 4 more years before we see this hit the road. I think for me, when I look back at 2026 Le Mans, obviously, like, it's one of the most satisfying wins I've seen in a long time. We talked about it narratively, the whole Toyota thing. Like, for me, I don't know if that was... If I have to think about it, then it probably wasn't one of the best Le Mans I've ever seen. But I have to say, it may not be the best, but it was one of the best, I'd say. I came away with that race thoroughly entertained.
I would call that a very solid, I would say, 7.5 to 8 out of 10 Le Mans. Worth a rewatch.
Just a very good, highly fought, competitive race all the way to the end. You never really knew who was going to win all the way through. We had a Le Mans effectively won by 10 seconds after 24 hours of racing. You can't scoff at that. Now, that is a race that will keep you on edge, keep you on your toes all the way through. And we have multiple manufacturers in play. And I think the top end of this race was fascinating to watch. And yeah, maybe we didn't get a grandstand finale because we've been spoiled for them in recent years, but still just an overall excellent race. And as Kira points out in the chat, the 1 hour version of this, absolutely prime time viewing. Go watch it.
Absolutely. And to that effect, I mean, much has been made of the narrative around this Toyota win. And now the question is when they can get another one. TR-010's pretty good.
You know what helps? It doesn't look like a warmed over relic from the past. It looks like a proper hypercar. It looks like a Toyota GT1 from the future. And that's why it had God's mandate to win. Doggone it.
And again, in defeating BMW, it feels like the ghost of that old warrior from the 90s can finally rest. And indeed. I like that.
Indeed. That'll do for Le Mans for this year. It'll be back next year, of course. We'll be covering that as we do on Motorsport 101. Next time out, we'll be talking MotoGP and its return to Brno. Looking forward to that as ever. Proper track, that is. Looking forward to that one. And IndyCar at its best track on the calendar, not named Indianapolis. It's at Road America. Love me some Road America.
And they just turned all the hybrid systems down for reliability reasons.
Oh, great. I can't wait to dig into that bullshit on next week's doubleheader. But that'll be next time. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison. They've been RJ O'Connor and Cameron Buckley. Thank you very much for watching and listening. And we'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
Later, y'all.
TSO 2010, you are avenged.